Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Why those cities and not, I don't know, Worthing?
Well, Worthing would be an excellent location. So I'm sorry that we missed out on Worthing, but
Worthing's sorry too.
Stage door Johnny. Not a lie, the rhymes with Johnny. But here it is, Stage Door Johnny.
Hello, welcome to Stage Door Johnny, the podcast about theatre and life. And life in the theatre. My name's Jonathan Cake. Thank you so much for joining me. Now, my guest this week is Simon Godwin. Hands down, flat out, no contest, one of Britain's finest stage directors. He's an associate director of the National Theatre. He's an associate director of the Royal Court Theatre. He's an associate director of the Bristol Old Vic Theatre. Everybody wants to associate with him. Oof, that's poor. He's artistic director of the mighty Washington Shakespeare Company in America. And he's currently in his third theatrical collaboration with the brilliant Ray Fiennes. They started off doing Man and Superman by Shaw together at the National, then the best production I've ever seen of the notoriously difficult Antony Cleopatra with Sophie Okonedo playing opposite Rafe. And now they are in London with their celebrated site-specific production of Macbeth, with Rafe as the Thane of Cawdor opposite Indira Varma as Lady M. And when we met in summer 2023, last year, Simon had not started rehearsals for this play. So we talk a lot about the gestation of this production, which is now on. If you're lucky enough, you can catch it and see all those ideas that we talked about that were just beginning to cook in Simon's mind, reaching their fruition in this production. I haven't seen it yet, and I cannot wait to, because it sounds incendiary. Simon and I worked together, actually, in 2018 on another notoriously difficult play, Measure for Measure, in New York. I played the Duke, and Simon is just a sort of glass of theatrical champagne. To be in a rehearsal room with him is this forensically brilliantly rigorous mind, as you'll hear in our chat, but also a sort of lightness of spirit, which, as you'll also hear in our chat, must come from a 2-year diversion that he took into the world of the body in performance. I won't spoil it too much, but it was an extraordinary tangent that Simon decided to take at a very daring moment in his career. So there's a sort of joyous quality to working with Simon, which I just loved. One of the most purely pleasurable directors I've ever had the pleasure of pleasuring. The pleasure of being in a rehearsal room with. Oh, and if this conversation sounds a little echoey, a little baronial, well, there's a good reason for that, because in advance of Simon's production of Macbeth with Ray Fiennes, we met last summer in the magnificent surroundings of Cawdor Castle in Scotland. That's right. We sat in a corner of the great hall. The walls were decked with clan tartans. Suits of armour flanked us as we sat in a broad bay window. We looked out across the rolling glen to this glittering and silvery burn, which was just winding its way to the purpling blue of the highlands of Scotland, rising majestically beyond. We had a fine, small-batch malt whiskey by our sides, and I started off by telling him how, when I was researching him, his wise words had saved me from falling too deeply into this sort of house-buying stress morass that I was in danger of losing myself in at the time. Oh, and none of that about where we're talking is true. I think perhaps you already picked up on that. We just met in a slightly echoey conference room in my agent's office in London. But come on, it's a theatre podcast. If we all conspire with our imaginations to believe it, can't it be true?
Gentlemen of the Stage Door Johnny Company, this is your beginner's call. Mr. Cake and Mr. Godwin to the stage, please. This is your beginner's.
So the reason I found you extremely comforting was when I was looking at a lecture you gave last night. You didn't give a lecture last night, I was looking at it. So I think I want to call it the Goodwin, or am I getting that confused with your name? The Godwin Lecture. It should have been called the Godwin Lecture. It was a lecture about Shakespeare that I found in the depths of YouTube.
God, wow, okay.
Perfect. You've given so many, you probably can't remember it. Anyway, one of the things you said, and you've said this to me before, is that magnificent quote at the end of Hamlet, Act 5, Scene 2, I think. If it be now, tis not to come. If it be not to come, it will be now. If it be not now, yet it will come. The readiness is all. The way you delivered it, by the way, was completely beautiful in your inimitable fashion. And it really sort of, honestly, it lifted something from my deep perturbation.
Yes,
inability to think about anything else. This monomaniacal sort of obsession with where we're going to be.
Yes.
And so I suppose, first of all, thank you for that. Because it's Shakespeare, of course, but your communication of it. It's a very beautiful lecture, by the way, even though you can't remember it. It's very, very lovely. And it relieved something of real deep care. And so I suppose I wanted to start off by asking you, are you able to do that when you direct? Are you able to be in the world and not try to force the world to your will? How does that possibly work? We know what Hamlet advises, that sense of taking yourself out of the need to impose when is this going to happen?
Well, thank you, Jonathan. I think your question relates to egotism and selfishness and selflessness and where all those things fit in the creative process. So as a director, you're both trying to be very present and very, as it were, full of yourself in the rehearsal room in terms of coming up with ideas, being well prepared, feeling like you've really got a sense of a vision. And you're also trying to be self-effacing and ego-free in order to catch the proposals and offers that are coming from other people and other people creating together in this shared space that is the rehearsal room. So that movement between presence and useful absence is one that I'm trying to get right every day. And it's a very difficult balance to strike. And it also depends a lot on your collaborators and how much others are trying to also move between the two places of emptiness and receptivity and plenitude and proposals. And this is one of the many things that helps to create a happy rehearsal room or an unhappy one.
Do you mind if we talk about the absolute specifics? Because I'm sort of fascinated by, not being a director, what you do, the wheels that turn to make a production happen, and what empty rooms you leave to be discovered, or unfurnished, or deliberately unadorned. So it's flogging this metaphor. So, for example, you're about to direct Macbeth. By the way, what should we call it?
Let's call it Macbeth.
I'll
be calling it Macbeth.
Will you?
Yeah.
What if people don't like that?
It's a good question. Well, that's back to presence and absence, isn't it? Preparedness and openness. So I guess if the room decides to call it by another name, I hope I'll be flexible enough to say, oh, okay, we'll call it Twelfth Night.
So you're about to direct, we'll call it Macbeth, you're about to direct Macbeth in a variety of different places. You're going to start in Liverpool and then Edinburgh, I may get this wrong.
Yeah.
London.
Yeah.
And then Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Where you are running the Shakespeare Theatre. And you're going to do it in site-specific venues. So already you've made decisions about that, I suppose. And I suppose what I want to know is what started off? Why are you doing Macbeth? And how did it begin?
Yes, good. So Macbeth, Began a long time ago, insofar as it began with my dialogue with Ralph Fiennes, who I directed in Man and Superman at the National Theatre, and then went on to direct as Antony, also at the National Theatre, in Antony and Cleopatra. And having done those two plays, we spoke about what would be interesting, compelling, fun to do next. And Ralph shared his ambition of playing Macbeth. And I think he felt, and actually he's been proved right, that the play is often done and has been proved right insofar as this year it's being done, I think, at the Globe, the Royal Shakespeare Company, English Touring Theatre, the Donmar Warehouse, and us. So, yes, absolutely, the play is more ubiquitous than ever. Right. So his sense, his hunch was, before we even think about the detail of the production, think about a space in which that play would speak newly or with greater impact.
That was Rafe's
thought. Yeah.
Okay.
And so he felt, rather than the traditional stalls and programmes and not much space to move around and a hierarchical seating pattern with the traditional theatre-going habits, what kind of space would be the empty space, the Brookian empty space, to look at the play afresh, but also to look at the whole experience of seeing a play afresh, and indeed, who's at the play, and the whole experience, I suppose, of seeing a play could be reviewed and refreshed. Hence the idea of doing it in environments that are not currently theatres, but that we are turning into theatres for the séance, or the event, or the journey that is Macbeth.
Gosh, the séance that is Macbeth. Do you think of it as a séance?
I think all theatre is a conjuring, and all theatre you're trying and hoping the gods are going to descend, as in West Africa, on your back, to bring you inspiration and to transport you. Right. And as we both know, Jonathan, sometimes you call for the gods to come and they answer and they arrive, and sometimes they don't. And so I think the Ouija board of the rehearsal room does feel very accurate, especially with a play that is in itself about apparitions and voices and external voices and internal voices, and how to tell the difference between between them.
So were the locations based on the site-specific places for the play that you could find? Was there a reason why those cities and not, I don't know, Worthing?
Well, Worthing would be an excellent location. So I'm sorry that we missed out on Worthing. But
Worthing's sorry too.
It was a strangely instinctive experience in that we wanted to find a city embedded in culture that still felt a space that was a place that had a kind of resonance or mythical place in the national consciousness. And for both Ralph and I, Liverpool seemed to be that city. It has a great theatre tradition, and yet it still occupied a very particular identity in the British psyche. We set off looking around for spaces in Liverpool, and we got in touch with the producers who, Wessex Grove and Underbelly, who specialise in site-specific work. They've done a lot of theatre in Edinburgh. That's been their major... Their bread and butter has been transforming spaces in Edinburgh for the festival. So they were used to the idea of this kind of search. And I went to Liverpool and I walked around numerous different spaces that had been found there. And we came up with a few finalists, and then Ralph went to Liverpool and looked at them, and we found one. And then that led to us finding another one in Edinburgh, and then London, and then Washington. But the other thing that we were looking for were spaces that could lend themselves to a militaristic atmosphere, insofar as a play about war and a play about tyranny felt an opportunity for us to speak about what's going on in Europe now, not in a fail-safe, explicit way, since of course Shakespeare didn't know what was going to be going on in Ukraine 400 years after he wrote his play, yet to not acknowledge or engage with that seemed to be, if we were going to do a contemporary production, which was our plan, our dream, would seem somehow inappropriately coy, let's say. So these spaces we chose for having an edge to them and a capability to be transformed into a sort of participatory warscape that you would walk through on your way to taking your seat for the actual play.
Are you very excited about that? Or is there something a little scary about not being in a normal theatre space and having all those tools to play with?
Yes, I think it's not until you contemplate leaving a theatre space that you do realise their value. Yeah. The fact that they are acoustically incredibly sensitive and well-equipped, as you say, the sight lines are great, and they're painted the right colour inside, they're dark, so you can have a blackout, there isn't any light spill from unexpected places, they have good toilets, there's a nice bar that you can buy your gin and tonic beforehand. All the things, of course, we were trying deliberately to move away from are nonetheless very attractive when you do say goodbye to them. So we're having to start from scratch. We're having to think about the facilities, about the heating, about the air conditioning, about the height. One thing I've come to realise is how high theatres are. We don't realise that until you look at other spaces. The reason being, of course, theatres are so high is that your seating rate can go up, and can go up in a fairly vertiginous way so that you're not too far away from the stage. When your ceilings are lower, that becomes a more difficult project. So there are lots of things that we're grappling with. But in the process of reinvention that it demands of all of us, there's also great energy in that.
And do you feel like it needs it? I mean, meaning... not that this production of Beth needs it, it obviously does, but do you feel like this is one way the theatre can try to think about broadening its appeal? Deconstructing those things that might deter some people from going to a regular theatre.
I think anything that makes us feel like we're going to an event that seems to have a pressing urgency and an excitement beyond that which we already know is to the great help of theatre. The same producers, Underbelly, who I mentioned just now, have also produced or co-produced The Cabaret in the West End, which is also involving a transformation of a theatre. And having gone to that and really felt the energy and excitement of not quite knowing what to expect or where to go or who the dancer was that was approaching me and sitting on my knee, certainly gave it an exhilaration that normal theatre doesn't have. And to your point about access, yes, I think the theatre coming to the audience is an appropriate and meaningful gesture. I don't know the last time the National Theatre or the Royal Shakespeare Company has played, for example, in Liverpool, but it certainly feels very galvanising for us as a company to go to that city to meet people who we would not normally meet.
So you did those two shows with Rafe. He comes to you, you have a conversation about what next? You want to continue this collaboration? And can I just ask you, what are you getting from Rafe? Why do you think the two of you have this alchemy that makes you want to continue this journey of collaboration together?
Well, I think that Rafe and I both are fascinated by language and its power to influence and change reality. And the other thing I feel is that Rafe is an extremely engaged and collaborative artist, and that he's directed, he's written, and for him to have a collaborator in me who is very willing and excited to hear ideas and to be a partner in projects, rather than perhaps some directors which their special skill lies in the infallible plan which they hope the actors will execute accurately. My approach is much more fluid and starts with questions and or is hungry for impressions and ideas from others. And I think that's meant to be fun for us both. And these are big peaks to tackle. So they're not, I mean, maybe fun is not always the word, but has meant that there's been a shared endeavour, which has been meaningful for both
of us. Not always fun?
Well, insofar as I don't think climbing a mountain is fun necessarily. There are moments of fun,
right?
But there's also moments of daunting terror and panic. And are we going to get to the top? And are we moving in the right direction? Do we have all that we need? Are we on track? And all these life-affirming questions that you face when you embark on a really difficult creative quest, which, as you know, Jonathan, because as you say, as you were just saying, you've done them. These titles and these plays, be it Shaw or Shakespeare, ask a lot of us.
When you're mountaineering and one of you is panicking, do you share your panic with him, or is it your job to project certainty confidence. Can you ever admit you're finding it difficult to get up the scree through the blizzard?
I think there's a difference, isn't there, between certainty and confidence. And arguably, you can be confident enough to say that you're not certain about something. And yet, if you're underconfident, you often seek certainty. So I feel like my job is to hold the space for discoveries to be made. And there is some parallels between the director and the therapist. And I think those of us who've been on the couch would not welcome a therapist that said, well, I don't know what's going on.
Right.
Unless it was a tactic to encourage the patient to move towards greater autonomy or right. self-sufficiency or self-belief.
Right.
So there are strategies that we all use, both in life and love and in art. But fundamentally, you do need to believe that the therapist knows what they're doing when they say, well, I don't know what that dream means. Do you?
I completely understand that difference between confidence and certainty. Do you think, therefore, I really want to get back to the fundamentals of how you evolve a production up to the point where you're not in the rehearsal room yet. Are you? No. But before we do, just on that train of thought, do you ever feel like directing is performative? Like there is a sort of act you're playing?
Yes, I do. I think role-playing and mask-wearing is a very healthy and creative pursuit. But it wasn't until my late 20s that I realised that, when I had started my career in Northampton at the Royal Theatre in that city. I was an associate director, so I was sort of resident director, or number two, I suppose, to Rupert Gould, who was running it at the time.
Yeah.
And I think I felt at that point, having done my degree at Cambridge, that my job as a director was to be serious, to be responsible, to be knowledgeable and kind of bossy in a sternish sort of way. Mm. And as I did more plays in my 20s, I began to not enjoy that role, and in a way was moving too often towards a faux certainty as opposed to a confidence, and was finding myself worn out and uninspired by my own work. And that's when I met Thomas Pratke, who had come over to London from Paris, who had run the Lecoq School. When Jacques Lecoq died, Thomas took over and then decided what he wanted to do was to create his own training journey. So he'd come to London to do that in the form of a school called LISPA, the London International School of Performing Arts. So I ended up doing, for lots of reasons, a weekend workshop with Thomas. And what was striking for me is to discover how light Thomas was, how witty he was, how playful, how mischievous, how irreverent, how audacious. And all the things that I thought I wasn't really meant to be as the responsible school teacher, Thomas was able to access. And I then ended up leaving my job with Rupert in Northampton and spending 2 years with Thomas.
2 years?
Yeah. And just doing the full Lecoq journey under Thomas's guidance and being with him every day.
That must have taken incredible courage to give up a good job. Also, you were on a sort of theatre conveyor belt, English at Cambridge, and moving through great assistant work and directing plays in very, very well thought of theatres. And you stop for 2 years to do a clowning.
Well, that's right. I mean, I remember Rupert saying to me when I went into his office and said I was doing this, well, you'll never come back. And it was a striking moment. And yet, when decisions are made, they tend to be made for you, I think, if we all recall decisions that we've made in our lives.
We're back to my mortgage.
We're back to your mortgage. that you're just in it. This has happened to you. And I was in it. The decision had been made. And there was no turning back.
Huh.
So I received Rupert's advice with gratitude, but then packed up my bags and left my little flat in Northampton and moved to West London and started the course. And as we were speaking earlier about mountaineering, it was fun for maybe 5%, but the rest of it was embarrassing, ludicrous, confusing, deeply infused with failure, and also joyous, and also life-changing.
Did you have to do all that stuff where you... I've heard of these extraordinarily terrifying-sounding clowning courses where you can't leave the circle until you've made everybody laugh. Things like that.
Yes. I mean, I think that those listening will know that the Lecoq method has always been part clowning.
Right.
But also, he was very interested in, for example, the Greek chorus and its relationship to the tragic dimension. He was also very interested in mask work, so the neutral mask related to the chorus, but also the bouffon and different dramatic territories. So of which clowning is one of them, but by no means everything. But having said that, yes, the whole gamut of acrobatics every week and more psychological exercises where you revisit the bedroom of your childhood and find the toy that you loved most as a child and play with it only to discover at the end of the improvisation a mirror in which you see your true self and realize you're no longer a child and must face that and leave the bedroom of your childhood. I mean, as we can both feel, these exercises have enormous potential for emotional impact or release. And I was doing those exercises as someone with really very little talent or skill or physical aplomb. I was a Cambridge graduate who didn't quite arrive in my black lace-up shoes on day one, but I certainly wasn't in my leotard, as many of the other my esteemed colleagues were wearing. So it was a journey, an immersive journey into the body and into the instinct.
And you felt you needed that, and did you have an idea of where it might lead? No, you gave yourself to the experience without thinking, I'm going to prove Rupert Gould wrong and come back a theatre director who just has access to the body to complement my extreme access to my head.
Yes, I think at some level there was a game plan around somewhere.
Right.
And I knew that my career as a director of plays in the mould that I had been in was over. So this was the way of not wrecking my career, but staying actually as a director. I had to undergo this metamorphosis if I was going to stay in the world of the arts.
This is all reminding me of an extraordinary moment in our rehearsal room, because we should say we've worked together.
Absolutely,
very happily. Directed me as the Duke in Measure for Measure in New York Theatre for a New Audience in 2018. Just as you were talking about the experience of that class and facing your adult self and all the extremity you must have gone through and discomfort and your ability to face discomfort. I remember I don't know if you remember this incident, but we were an exchange of views once. I think the whole sort of room was. I can't remember what part of the play it was, but it was extremely famously and difficult play. And we were, as all actors and directors do, having a dialogue about something in it. And at a moment that I will never forget, I think I probably disagreed with you about something, I hope respectfully. Simon is making shrugging gestures, as though I want everyone to know, as though that's, of course, par for the course. You did this extraordinary thing where you stopped and shrank. And you went, without wordlessly, to sit down at the side of the room, not at the front of the room, where you would normally sit to see the action of the play straight on. And you sat there just thinking in this extraordinarily arresting moment. All the sort of pretense, if we can call it that, all the sort of role-playing of who we were, actor, cast, director, stopped. And you as a human being did this extraordinary thing. It really did seem like a physical thing, that the air had got taken out of you and you needed to go and stop to reclaim it, understand what was going on. Mm. Makes it sound much more sort of confrontational than I think it was.
Yes.
At least I remember it. Do you remember it?
I can feel, as you describe the gesture, I can sort of see myself making it. And I think a phrase that I use a lot in rehearsals is from Peter Brook. The phrase, hold on tightly, let go lightly. And maybe, Jonathan, what I was doing in that moment was letting go of something in favour of something else that was appearing, even if that thing wasn't formed yet. But it's a cause of such difficulty for all of us and such conflict, both in the workplace and in the world, when we become glued to an opinion. I am my opinion. So to criticise my opinion is to criticise me. How can we shed or release ourselves from, or as Lecoq would say, introduce distance between the mask and the performer? Mm. That there's always creative room for us all to, oh, is it that? Let's try. Oh, it's not that. Let's try something else. And I, as the director, have to check myself as much as anybody else that I am practicing what I preach. was this a moment when I was about to become strident and demand that an idea be followed or continued? Or did I need to actually remove myself and think, well, good, maybe there's something I'm missing here. Maybe I should let go of something.
It was, of course, the most extraordinary way to get a room full of people devoted to you. And I'm not at all accusing you of a premeditated gesture of humanity. But in this extreme physical embodiment of something that was there and then smaller, and then was just merely thinking, contemplating what had just happened, feeling what had just happened, it was unbelievably moving and human. And maybe that thing of confidence and certainty was perfectly demonstrated then. The confidence to sit down and allow yourself to physically process what had just happened, or what was happening, I thought was really remarkable, and made me think of that, because there was something not unakin to a clowning moment from one persona distinctly back into a humanity or something. It was rather beautiful.
Well, I think also what I think of, Jonathan, when you're speaking, is this word, and I wish I knew the origins of it, vulnerability. It's a word we sort of toss around a lot, but I think ultimately great meaning derives from the vulnerable. And it goes back to masks, unhelpful masks, insecurity, positions. And the opposite of all of that is vulnerability. And and akin to vulnerability is curiosity. Really, how are we going to tell this story most clearly? What is the shared language that only you and I or whoever else is in this room can find? What is really this, could this play be about, or the story be about now? And for somebody who doesn't know the story, that's coming to it for the first time, all of these questions have so much more energy than answers.
So, back to the stages that a production goes through, just because I think it's, anyway, I'm sort of fascinated by what you have to do to get to the point of going into rehearsal for the first day. So you and Rafe talk about Macbeth, and then Rafe says, but I don't want to do it in a traditional space. And you're like, okay, this is fascinating. You've just seen Cabaret, or saw it maybe later. And the two things sort of gelled, and you thought, oh, this could be a really wonderfully disruptive way of staging this play. And then what's the process then? To cut the play? What's generally next once you and he have hit on a shared idea?
Yeah, I think this question of editing Shakespeare or cutting Shakespeare is very germane, not least because it wasn't until I worked with Patrick Marber on The Beau Stratagem at the National Theatre that I directed. And here was a play that Farquhar died whilst completing. So the ending gets more and more strange and less satisfactory as it reaches its last page. And I don't think he had any time really to go back through the play and tidy up loose ends. So it's an exciting, vibrant script, but it's an incomplete script. So contemplating directing it to the National, I went to Patrick and asked him whether he would help me rescue the play. And he brilliantly agreed to do so. And we spent a long time together looking at Farquhar's language and the play as it stood and figuring out how to make subtle and sympathetic adjustments. But in doing that, I realized, this is actually where directing starts. Because the moment you cut a line or you reorder a line, or indeed you add a stage direction, it achieves a sort of authority, which however much you in the rehearsal room as the director say, hey, should we change this line? Or do you want to move over and make a cup of tea during this line? It will never have as much weight as the actor saying, oh, in the script it says I've got to go and make a cup of tea on this line. And the fact that I've actually written that line in several months ago is sort of wonderfully forgotten, because it's achieved the status of authorial intent. So as a strategy by which directing, subliminal directing begins, editing, changing, and, well, we say stage directions, writing your directions in at an earlier stage is a really helpful method, I've realized. And then the more broad question of how to cut Shakespeare. Well, I've made a film in the lockdown with Jesse Buckley and Josh O'Connor of Romeo and Juliet. And that
which
was
you
nice.
Were going to stage. You were going to stage
as a play.
Lockdown happened, and brilliantly you pivoted to this beautiful film, which keeps something of the theatrical.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, thanks, Jonathan. It's sort of set in, we turned the Littleton into a sort of film and TV soundstage, and there are ways that we move between the sort of rehearsal room and more fully realised sort of filmic sets. But it was 90 minutes long, and I think Romeo and Juliet is probably nearly 3 hours if you do all of it. And so that was a radical abridgment. And yet we discovered that Shakespeare really enjoys the speed a film especially can bring. That even in Romeo and Juliet, he says the 2 hours traffic of our stage in the prologue. I mean, it's very rarely done at that length because of the fact that I should say all the words would take you much more than 2 hours.
Galloping pace, you fiery-footed steeds, would have to be very galloping.
Very galloping.
To be 2 hours.
So I think what we can deduce from all of that is that Shakespeare wrote more than he needed. That he was probably never imagining that everyone was going to say all of his words. But for whatever reason, maybe he just loved writing. Maybe he wanted to give lots of options to the company. Maybe he got carried away. Who knows? But the plays are too long for performance, in my opinion. Brevity is the soul of wit.
Even Macbeth, which is notoriously his
shortest play. And yet, I just noticed, because I'm going on Thursday to see the new Royal Shakespeare Company production, that it currently starts at 7:15 and is down by 10:30. Right. Which I think is a long evening.
Sure.
I mean, it may well be a majestic evening. So the idea that, again, with any of these plays, if you just, even the short ones are short, is not right. Right. Not least, perhaps, though, because we have scene changes. Shakespeare, of course, didn't. There was no scenery at the Globe. You just moved instantaneously. Which I think is another interesting thing about often why the last line of a scene of Shakespeare fits so beautifully against the first line of the following scene. Because he knew they would be spoken adjacently. And the distance we have between the last and the first lines of a scene can really affect the meaning and drama of these plays. Yes, I'm a big fan of cutting. And in the case of Macbeth, I go away and I actually been working with Emily Burns, who did the script of Romeo and Juliet and has been helping me adapt Shakespeare for a number of years. And she prepared a first edit of the script of Macbeth. And now I'm in the process of figuring out what do we put back? What do we defend as a cut that helps us? And what's the balance? Because you don't want to use that funny expression, throw the baby out with the bathwater. And yet, every production does need to fight for its own identity, especially, as I said earlier, these plays that are being done so often.
And as you're cutting, or Emily's cutting and you're working together, Rafe is involved too, presumably. Are you deciding more about the play, or does it just feel like a gathering of information? And are you doing critical? Are you reading critical studies? Mm. Are you saying you're going to go and see other productions of it, which perhaps some other people wouldn't? I think there is a school of directorial thought, certainly actors, who won't want to go and see another production, won't want to go and see another actor playing that part that they're about to play for fear of having something indelible sort of forced on them, or too much knowledge. Where do you stand on all that?
I believe in maximum exposure as a director, because I think any production of a play you're working on is so helpful in that it puts you through the play. It forces you to go on the journey. It's not like reading it at home where you read a little bit and then you go and make a cup of tea or you go and put your child to bed and then you come back. It's a sustained experience of the play. And the more sustained experiences of the play, the more one learns about the play. The more one learns about the strengths of the play as well as what I call the traps of the play. So, for example, I recently saw Macbeth at the Globe, but I was really aware, which I wouldn't have done on the page, of how many moments there are when characters come onto the stage having witnessed horrific scenes. Most notably, the discovery that the King Duncan has been murdered. And actually, it reminded me, goodness, there's a real art in actors coming on stage and reporting visions that they've seen off stage. It's surprisingly difficult.
Yeah.
So that makes me think, good, well, maybe I've learned from that my first couple of days of rehearsal, I should do an exercise or create an improvisation in which folks come in to one room having witnessed something terrible in another room, so that we as a company can just think about that. And what happens to the body when it's undergone a trauma like that? Where does one look? Does one cry? Does one not? Does one freeze? Does one not? Does one speak quickly? Does one speak slowly? All of these things I don't know the answer to, but living the play helps inform what I will do. And the other thing, Jonathan, is that there is going to be a very small number of people who will see the Globe and the Royal Shakespeare Company and the Donmar and ours, and they are called critics. And if I open my production the same way as the RSC does, I mean, on one level, if it works, it works. But on the other level, I've got to be bringing something new to the table. And I can only bring something new to the table if I know what's already on the table.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Okay, that's Lights Down on Act 1 of my chat with the wonderful Simon Goldwyn. Please join me for Act 2, where you're going to hear us chat about how not to be affected by the horror in Macbeth, the difference between immersion and identification, how much mystery Simon likes to leave in the understanding of a play, the 3 a.m. director thinks, why he's also fine with leaving a show, how directing a play is like working in HR sometimes, why he loves the first days of rehearsal, Shakespeare's school of life, his fear of unemployment, and why A Christmas Carol at the Tabard Theatre is so special to him. Come back, please, and join me for the second part of my chat. You won't be disappointed.
Stage, stage, stage door Johnny. Stage, stage, stage door Johnny. Not a line rhymes with Johnny, but here it is, stage door Johnny. Stage, stage, stage door Johnny. Sits in the balcony, sees plays sad and funny. That's stage, stage door Johnny. Stage.